Watch out, readers. Here it comes. Memoirs light the corners of my mind. Oh, watch out, readers. I might continue singing, or at least humming. Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and while probing popular titles this week, I found a preponderance of memoirs. So, okay, we haven't been down memory lane recently, and apparently we're more than overdue. I've found great selects from music, politics, sports, and real folks with stories that will fascinate. Ready to be entertained? I know I am. So let's turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz. We're there when you can't be.
He called her Mrs. Kennedy. She called him Mr. Hill. For 4 years, from the election of JFK in November 1960 until Johnson was elected in 64, Clint Hill was the Secret Service agent assigned to guard the glamorous and intensely private Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy. During those 4 years, he went from being a reluctant guardian to a fiercely loyal watchdog and, in many ways, her closest friend. Now, looking back 50 years, Clint Hill tells his story for the first time in Mrs. Kennedy and Me, an intimate memoir, written with Lisa McCubbin. The book offers a tender portrayal of how a Secret Service agent who started life in a North Dakota orphanage became the most trusted man in the life of a First Lady who captivated the nation and the world. From the start, the job was like no other, and Clint was by her side through the early days of the presidency, the birth of sons John and Patrick, Patrick's sudden death, Kennedy family holidays in Hyannis and Palm Beach, trips to Europe, Asia, and South America. Then, Jackie's meetings with the likes of Ari Onassis and Andre Malraux, and to the dark days that followed the assassination. Filled with startling revelations and sparkling intimate moments, this is a once-in-a-lifetime story. Jeremy Bob narrates.
It was with great trepidation that I approached 3307 N Street in Georgetown on November 11, 1960. I was about to meet the wife of the newly elected President of the United States, who I had just been assigned to protect. And I wasn't looking forward to it at all. Being on the First Lady's Secret Service detail was the last place I wanted to be. Looking back, I'm quite sure that Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy was filled with even more anxiety about our meeting than I was. Neither of us had much choice in the matter. She could refuse to accept me, as she had done with the first agent assigned to her, but if I rejected the assignment, it would be the end of my career. Just 24 hours earlier, I had been with outgoing President Dwight D. Eisenhower as he played a post-election round of golf at Augusta National Golf Course. The fact that the Republicans had lost the election was still sinking in, and while the entire administration was about to change, one of the few things that would remain the same was the Secret Service. It had been a great honor for me to be on President Eisenhower's Secret Service detail, and while it would be bittersweet to see him leave office, I was excited for the challenge and experience of protecting the new president. It never entered my mind that my job might not be as secure as I thought it was. There were just 40 of us on the White House Secret Service detail, the elite team whose sole mission was to protect the president around the clock. We were not affiliated with any party or political group, and we were a tight group of men. The transition would require the Secret Service to adapt to the new president's style, and even though I hadn't yet met President-elect John F. Kennedy, it was obvious that protecting him was going to be a whole different ballgame than it had been with Ike. We were going from a 70-year-old former general who ran the White House with military precision to an energetic 43-year-old Irish Catholic Democrat from Massachusetts with a lot of new ideas to take America into the 1960s. I had been working the golf course with two other agents, and as soon as the president's foursome finished the round, Jim Rowley, the special agent in charge, SAIC, of the White House detail, sent word that he needed to speak to the three of us. I had a feeling this was probably my last game of golf with President Eisenhower, and fully expected that Rowley was about to reassign the three of us to President-elect Kennedy. When we walked into the office, Rowley explained that he had to shuffle the personnel in order to cover President Eisenhower along with President-elect Kennedy until the inauguration in January. First, he addressed the other two agents, Jerry Blaine and Bill Skiles. Jerry and Bill, you'll be on the President-elect detail. Mr. Kennedy is going to spend the next month and the holidays at his father's estate in Palm Beach, Florida, so you guys need to get on a flight down there this evening. He warned that they would likely remain in Florida until the inauguration, meaning they'd be away from their own families for Christmas and New Year's, and suggested they have their wives arrange to get some warm-weather clothing to them. As I was listening to Rowley give Blaine and Skiles their new assignment, an uneasy feeling started to come over me. Finally, Rowley turned to me and said, "Clint, Defense Secretary Tom Gates is here, briefing the president, and is returning to Washington shortly. I want you to fly back with him, then go to Secret Service headquarters and talk to Chief Bauman. The chief is expecting you." "Yes, sir," I said with a nod. Why does Bauman want to speak with me? Why am I not going to Palm Beach with Skiles and Blaine? I had a dozen questions, but I would never question Rowley's authority or decision. He was our leader. Still, I had a foreboding feeling that whatever lay ahead of me could not be good. Secret Service headquarters was located in the U.S. Treasury building, right next to the White House on Pennsylvania Avenue. I had never been in the chief's office before, and in fact, had never personally met Chief U.E. Bauman, who had been head of the Secret Service since 1948. I was more than a little apprehensive when I checked in with his secretary, but I tried to sound as confident as possible. "I'm Special Agent Clint Hill, here to meet with Chief Bauman." "Yes, Mr. Hill, the chief is expecting you," she said. "You may go on in." As I walked through the doorway into the chief's spacious office, the first thing I saw was a plaque hanging on the wall that said, "You ain't learning nothing when you're talking." Sound advice, I thought.
We've just heard Mrs. Kennedy and Me by Clint Hill. You were lucky enough to see Carole King touring with James Taylor on their recent Troubadour tour. Wow, I saw that concert and it was fabulous. When we were all in college, a few years ago, every freshman had Tapestry in their vinyl collection. Now, in A Natural Woman, Carole King takes us from her early beginnings in Brooklyn to her remarkable success as one of the world's most acclaimed songwriters and performers. A Natural Woman, narrated by Carole herself, chronicles an extraordinary life, drawing listeners into her musical world, including her wildly successful number one album, Tapestry, and into her journey as a performer, mother, wife, and present-day activist. Deeply personal, King's long-awaited memoir offers listeners a front-row view of the woman behind the legend.
"A few minutes ago, when I turned around to take off my guitar, I banged the headstock into the side of the piano visible to the audience. My guitar is cracked where the headstock meets the neck, and there's a big ding on the piano. But these are minor problems compared to the sensation I feel in my throat, the one I get when I'm about to lose my voice. How can I give my audience what they've come for if I don't have a voice? My bandmates, Rudy Guess and Gary Burr, try to dispel my anxiety. "Hey, it's okay," Gary volunteers. "Your voice will be there for the show." Rudy adds, "Carol, don't worry about the guitar. It wasn't your fault." Their consoling remarks only make me feel worse. I know why the guitar bang happened. It was because I was in too much of a hurry. My mood doesn't improve when John Vanderslice, our production manager, announces, "It's 6:55, doors open at 7, and you need to leave the stage right now." "But Slice, we didn't check our vocal balance or get a level on Earth Move." Usually, we play a chorus of "I Feel the Earth Move" in each new venue, so the sound team can assess our likely maximum volume. Whatever level of loud we achieve, the sound guys know it goes to louder during the actual performance and prepare accordingly. But how can they prepare if they never got to hear where loud was? "Sorry," Slice says, handing me my backpack and beckoning to the piano tuner in one fluid motion. As I head backstage, my manager, Lorna Guess, intercepts me. "Don't forget, you have a pre-show with some radio contest winners," she reminds me. "Why don't you put this on?" This is a lanyard with a hand-lettered laminated sign that says "Voice at Rest." It explains to others why I'm speaking only in hand signs and whispers, and at the same time reminds me not to speak unnecessarily. It's unusual for me to meet radio contest winners before a show. Usually I try to conserve my energy for the concert and greet people afterwards. But we have a long bus ride tonight and need to leave immediately after the performance. Touring bands call it play and wave. I have less than an hour to meet, greet, eat, and primp. I'm hoping the crew will be able to buff out the ding on the piano, raise the piano bench, eliminate the shadow on the keyboard, and get rid of the hum. I shouldn't worry. In over 30 years of performing in concert, I've never gone on stage and found a hum heard at soundcheck still there at showtime. But tonight, I am not in harmony with the universe. This is not a good way to feel before a show. Lorna brings me to the room known as Hospitality, where the radio contest winners are. These lovely people are longtime fans. Each has a story. They respect the "Voice at Rest" sign and do all the talking. I listen attentively and sign albums. By the time I've met them all, it's 7:20. Showtime is 8 o'clock. Lorna walks me over to catering. Gary and Rudy are at one table, and some of the crew are at another. Lorna joins her husband, Rudy, while I stop at the crew table. From their wry jokes, I learn that the air conditioning on their bus hasn't been working for the past few days. It's midsummer in the Midwest. Ignoring my "Voice at Rest" sign, I ask if there's anything I can do to hasten the arrival of a replacement bus. They tell me it's already on the way. I tell them I couldn't function on tour without them. They brush aside my compliments and urge me to enjoy my dinner and not worry about the bus, hums, broken guitars, or their ability to adjust for louder. Lorna signals me to stop talking. Like a flock of birds, the crew all get up at once to go back to work. Christian Walsh, the front-of-house sound man, stops long enough to assure me that everything will be working perfectly by showtime.
That was "Natural Woman" by Carol King. My guest today is Peter Ford, who's written a wonderful book about his dad, Glenn Ford, one of the last leading men from Hollywood's golden age. The all-American actor was actually born in Canada and was christened Gwilyn Samuel Newton Ford. Glenn had a distinguished career, starring in, to list a few, Gilda, Blackboard Jungle, Tea House of the August Moon, The Courtship of Eddie's Father, The Rounders, Pocketful of Miracles, Don't Go Near the Water, 310 to Yuma, and Superman. Glenn starred on the small screen, too, including such TV favorites as The Sacketts and the series Cades County. Glenn shared the screen with such legends as Betty Davis, Marlon Brando, Jack Lemmon, John Huston, Edward G. Robinson, Henry Fonda, Robert Mitchum, and the list goes on. America's top box office star of 1958 and a Golden Globe winner for his performance as Dave the Dude in The Pocketful of Miracles, Glenn remained an audience favorite for another 30 years. Glenn Ford's private life was often as dramatic as his movies. Quote, "We are all three people," the actor said in 1949. "The person we think we are, the person the world thinks we are, and the person we really are." Over the years, Glenn was linked romantically to dozens of Hollywood's leading ladies, including Joan Crawford, Brigitte Bardot, Debbie Reynolds, and Judy Garland. And Glenn's relationship with Rita Hayworth, his co-star in five films, survived four decades and was much more serious and complex than has ever been acknowledged publicly. Glenn was married four times, including the author's mother, Eleanor Powell, the tap dancing legend of movie musicals. Welcome, Peter. Thanks for stopping by the Book Report.
Well, thank you, Elaine.
You've written a wonderful book about your dad. What made you decide to pick up a pen and do it at this point?
Well, my dad was still alive, and he was 88 at the time. He's passed now. He lived to be 90. And Anne Francis, a dear friend of ours, was over here, the actress who was in so many wonderful films, but she was also my dad's wife in Blackboard Jungle, the film that he made in the mid-50s. And Annie said, Peter, you've got to write this book, because she knew the story, the good, the bad, the ugly, as it were. And so she'd been in my life since I was nine. So she prompted me, and it was Annie Francis who encouraged me to do it. And I thought, well, I've written things, nothing like that, like a book before, but I thought I'd give it a try. And it took me 7 years, Elaine, and my dad passed after two of them. And then I found his diaries. I knew he kept them, but he kept a diary every day of his life since he was 18. And boy, that was... that was interesting. So I went from a kind of a easygoing biography to a pretty in-depth analyzation of this father of mine, and you have the result.
Well, I understand that you have a very, very vibrant website. Tell us a little bit about that, and is any of the diary source material on the website?
Well, a lot of it's in the book, of course, but I tell you the truth. Well, anyway, the website is glennfordbio.com, G-L-E-N-N, two N's in Glenn, glennfordbio.com, and there's media links there, and just all kinds of information, biographical information, and there's a link there to my own personal website. So if anyone's interested in the golden age of Hollywood and my dad, and my mom, of course, was Eleanor Powell, who was a great actress, dancer at MGM, and I think they'd have fun there. But no, you know what, Elaine, I I've been asked by people to do more with the diaries, but they're so intimate. I could post things that weren't, too intimate, but they're so intimate that I just felt that I couldn't. I haven't even shown them to anybody. Believe me, I've been asked. So, but a lot of the information's in the book. But my dad was a very, very complex guy. Not the Jimmy Stewart, Glenn Ford kind of person you'd think he was. So. He was a very, very interesting character.
Well, I know that, first of all, your dad was born in Canada, and the family had been in the paper business, and then your grandfather switched to railroad. So how did your dad get started in the movie business?
Well, he was, to use the expression, he was a ham all of his, in his youth. I mean, he loved the acting. In fact, my grandmother told me that as a very, very small child, he'd have his mother and father sitting in chairs, and he'd hide behind a curtain in their home, and he'd open the curtain and step out and start reading the newspaper when he was just a little child. So I think it was just in the genes, but yes, you're right. He was born in Quebec City, 1916, and they emigrated to California, actually, to Venice, California, in 1922, but my grandfather, his father, was an engineer on the Canadian Pacific Railroad on the run between Quebec and Montreal. And So they decided to come to California. They had a relative here, and they were hearing about the seagulls and the orange trees, the smell of the sea, and fish, you know, that they could catch in the ocean. And it was just too much for them to not come, and they did.
Hmm. Well, you grew up in Hollywood, and your dad had so many screen legends as friends. Can you share some of your favorite stories of one or two notables?
Oh, well, yes. It was a bounty for me. They were just my parents' friends. But my mom was, as I said, a star at MGM. Before then, she was on Broadway as a youngster, really, and had quite a career back in New York. So from mom's friends, I mean, Jack Benny would come over, and Sophie Tucker, and Eddie Cantor, and Georgie Jessel, and Al Jolson. And then when my dad got going in the business, then it was all the movie people. Barbara Stanwyck and Eddie G. Robinson, and later, of course, it was John Wayne and all those people. But where I grew up, across the street was David O. Selznick, who some of you might know. Did some producing of some pretty significant films. And Fred Astaire lived up the street. Billy Wilder lived around the corner, and Charlie Chaplin was my next door neighbor. And I talk about this in the book. He very sadly for me anyway, happened to hit my dog Bill in his car. Bill used to chase cars, unfortunately, and so Charlie killed my dog. I mean, he didn't mean to, but that was quite traumatic. So that my life and the book are populated with all kinds of stories about those kinds of things.
Which was your dad's favorite role, or did he ever, talk about which one?
I would always say his favorite role was anything he did with Rita Hayworth, because he was he was, not only was he fond of her, but of course that breakout film for him was 1946 with Gilda that he made. But he loved anything with Rita. But he made so many different films and so many different genres. You'd have to almost go within each genre, and I think for the westerns it would be the original and the best 3:10 to Yuma. Although he liked making the Rounders with Henry Fonda, a sweet little film he did in the mid-60s. And, I don't know, for me personally, I think he did a heck of a job on TLC August Moon that he did with Marlon Brando. And in my opinion, he stole that movie from Marlon, and it was supposed to be Marlon's film.
When there was a time when you were pursuing an acting career as well, and you co-starred with him, isn't that right?
Well, I had a little bitty parts in some of his films. I did co-star in some films, but they weren't with Dad. I co-starred with Chuck Connors in a Western, and actually starred in a film, all by myself, called Wilbur and the Baby Factory. But with Dad, there was 8 or 9 of them, and I had little parts. But I did a lot of work as his dialogue director, and that's kind of a complicated thing to explain. But so I was on quite a few projects as a dialogue director, and with him and other films. But it was fun. I always had, little parts. I mean, I probably total of my lines, Elaine, would be maybe, 20 lines worth of dialogue over many, many years. So nothing to speak of. But we did do a TV series together called Cades County in 1971. I played his deputy, and we were on television. That one I was, busy on every episode. There was 26 episodes, so I had a lot of work to do there. But in the films, it would just be a few words here and there, but it's fun to see myself growing up, on film. It's kind of fun to see, yourself at age 14, 16, 18, et cetera. As I say in the book, Elaine, he was a great actor. He wasn't the best dad. I mean, there wasn't a lot of bothering going on. And again, the book is not, a Daddy Dearest or a negative book, as because you read it. But
right.
He was not, he did not take the time to be the father that I wished he had, but that's how it was, and I got over that, and we my wife and I moved in here toward the end of his life and took care of him for the last 12 years of his life. So, but he lived a full life, that's for sure. A lot of wine, women, and songs. He had a lot of fun. Yeah, my dad was very loyal. In fact, when we did Cades, he brought a lot of his old directors back who had not worked in a long time. Leo Penn, for one, Sean Penn's father. He'd work with, and a lot of these guys hadn't worked, and so when he had the power to do so, he would instruct 20th Century Fox and David Gerber, the producer, you know, I would like to have this director.
Your mother was a movie star in her own right, and are you working on her story next?
Well, I'd like to, Elaine, I really would. Her story is incredible. She talk about coming from tremendous poverty to great fame. I tell you, I spent so much time doing my dad's book. I know my mother's going to take just as long, and the older I get, the more I think I'm not going to have enough time to do it, but I would love to. Her story is quite compelling.
Well, I have to say that I really enjoyed the book. You made his life so accessible, so interesting, and of course, all of the people that he knew and interacted with are screen legends, and it's a wonderful book. Tell us again your website.
It's the book is Glenn Ford Alive. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. And but all of the information about me, the family, the book, photos of the family, and et cetera, are on www.glennfordbio.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. And readers, this is one book about Hollywood you are going to love. Thanks so much. All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Another musical memoir I think you'll enjoy is Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, My Life in Music, by, of course, Judy Collins. This highly evocative memoir from one of the reigning icons of folk music highlights the 1960s, when hits like Both Sides Now catapulted Collins to international fame. Sweet Judy Blue Eyes is the deeply personal, honest, and revealing memoir of a folk legend and a relentlessly creative spirit. Judy, who narrates, speaks frankly about her alcoholism, her lasting affair with Stephen Stills, her friendships with Joan Baez, David Crosby, and Leonard Cohen, and above all, the music that helped define a decade. Sweet Judy Blue Eyes invites the reader into the parties that peppered Laurel Canyon and into the recording studios, while it sets an array of amazing musical talent against the backdrop of one of the most turbulent decades of the 20th century.
Sweet Judy Blue Eyes will tell many stories I've never fully told, demons I've battled and tragedies I've endured. In 50 years in the music business, there are also the blessings and grace I have found through it all. I will tell how I found my way to my marriage to Lewis Nelson, and more than 33 years of living with a man who is my partner, my friend and lover, my solace and companion, whom I met when I thought I had lost everything that mattered. I will talk of faith and money, sex and drugs and rock and roll, about learning to sing and tour through all the days of shining sun as well as pouring rain. I will tell of my ongoing quest to become and to remain an artist. With the passage of time, I'm able to talk about circles that have been completed and old friends with whom I've reconnected. Many have died, each spiriting away a unique impression of me that no one else will ever have, each leaving a ghost of himself behind in my memory. These memories are my treasures. Memories of singers and poets, rabble-rousers and rebels, the closest of friends, the dearest of lovers, family members who were a part of me. There are so many, including Marjorie, my mother, Chuck, my father, and Clark, my son. Robert Richardson writes of the philosopher William James, "Trouble was for him a precondition for insight." I can only hope that the same is true for me, and that I have learned at least some of the lessons born not only of my own troubles and of those close to me, but also of the people for whose causes I have marched and rallied, raised money and gone to jail, and for whom I always, always sing. I will speak of the wars of an emotional nature against addictions, against suicidal depressions, against alcoholic drinking. These are not wars with fire and steel, but they are wars just the same, often with terrible prices to pay. No anti-war protest, no action against prevailing prejudice ever was fought harder than these. Through all these years, I've been eternally grateful for the gift of music. There are times when the sounds of the voices in my audiences singing along with the old sweet melodies are for me all that stand between despair and joy. When we sing, we can do anything. Change the world. Bring peace. Be our best selves at last. When we sing, our hearts can lift and fly over the troubled waters and over the years. Chapter 1. Ruby-Throated Sparrow. I am yours, you are mine, you are what you are. Stephen Stills, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. 1968, the year I met and fell in love with Stephen Stills, was a leap year. In the Chinese calendar, it was the year of the monkey, a year destined to explode with creativity, social upheaval, and tragedy. The U.S. involvement in Vietnam had escalated into all-out warfare and was tearing the country apart. Martin Luther King Jr., in whom we invested so much hope, had been murdered in Memphis on April 4th. The day after King's assassination, Robert F. Kennedy made one of the last speeches of his life at a political gathering in Indianapolis, originally intended as a rally for his run for president, reminding the weeping audience of black and white mourners that he, too, had lost a brother to a white man with a gun, and urging them, as the Greeks had put it, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world. Many young people were marching against the war, and music captured our conflicting feelings of disenchantment and romantic idealism from the traditional folk songs of the Weavers, "Wasn't That a Time?" and "Rock Island Line," to the powerful laments of singer-songwriters Dylan singing, "The Hard Rain's A-Gonna Fall," Phil Oak singing, "I Ain't Marchin' Anymore," and Joan Baez singing "Silver Dagger" in her haunting soprano.
That was Sweet Judy Blue Eyes by Judy Collins.
Social media, it's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
It happens every spring. Yankees pitching great Juan Guidry arrives at the Tampa airport to pick up national treasure Yogi Berra. Guidry drives him to the ballpark. They watch the young players. They talk shop. They eat dinner together, tease each other, trade stories, and the next day, they do it all over again. Driving Mr. Yogi, Yogi Berra, Ron Guidry, and Baseball's Greatest Gift by Harvey Arreton is the story of how a unique friendship between a pitcher and a catcher is renewed every year. It began in 1999 when Berra was reunited with the Yankees after a long self-exile, the result of being unceremoniously fired by Mr. George Steinbrenner 14 years before. A reconciliation between Berra and the boss meant that Berra would attend spring training again. Guidry befriended Mr. Yogi instantly. After all, Berra had been a mentor in the clubhouse back when Guidry was pitching for the Yankees. Guidry knew the young players would benefit greatly from Yogi's encyclopedic knowledge of the game. So he encouraged him to share his insights. Soon, an offhand batting trip from Barra turned Nick Swisher's season around. Stories about handling a hitter like Ted Williams or catching Don Larson's perfect game captured the player's imagination. And in Yogi, Guidry found not just an elder companion or a source of amusement, he found a best friend. By turns tender and laugh-out-loud funny, and teeming with baseball yarns that span more than 50 years, Driving Mr. Yogi is a universal story about the importance of wisdom being passed from one generation to the next. Peter Burkrot narrates.
He pushed open the driver's side door, stood up, and looked around for the airport traffic attendant. He hoped it would be the same sympathetic fellow he had encountered the previous year. "Can I help you?" the guy had said when he'd noticed Guidry looking around uneasily. "Yeah, I'm waiting for a highly valued package," Guidry had replied. "Are you a baseball fan?" The attendant had said, "No, not really." But when Guidry had told him who he had come to pick up, "I'm waiting for a little dude by the name of Barra." He had gotten the thoroughly predictable response. The attendant's eyes had widened. Of course he had heard of Barra. "Yogi's coming," he had said. "Why don't you go inside and wait for him? I'll watch your truck." Unfortunately, a year had passed, and now all Guidry saw was a uniformed female employee who eyed him suspiciously as he edged a few steps from the truck in the direction of the terminal. Guidry decided not to risk it, because the only thing worse than not being where Barra expected him to be would be having the truck towed and having no ride at all. So Guidry stood like a sentry in his white, short-sleeved, button-down shirt, which hung just below the belt line of his dark slacks. At age 60, he was starting to turn gray, his combed-back hair barely clinging to its natural dark glint. Otherwise, the man celebrated by Yankees fans as Louisiana Lightning remained trim and tanned enough to be mistaken at a glance for a player in his prime. It was late on the afternoon of February 22, 2011. Being in Tampa at this time of year was a ritual of late winter for Guidry, a foreshadowing of the calendar spring. After his retirement from the Yankees in 1989, he had returned every year as a special camp instructor, with the exception of the 2 years he had served as the team's pitching coach, 2006 and 2007, and the strike year, 1995, when baseball had tried to ram replacement players down the public's throat during spring training. There was no way he was showing up for that. He never flew to Tampa, preferring instead to load his truck for the 11-hour drive from his handsome gated home on about 70 rustic acres outside Lafayette, Louisiana, a straight shot on Interstate 10 across Mississippi, Alabama, and on into northern Florida's western flank. From there, Guidry would head south on Interstate 75, the final leg into the Yankees' training base, directly across Dale Mabry Highway from Raymond James Stadium, home of the NFL's Tampa Bay Buccaneers. By this breezy Tuesday afternoon, he had already been in camp for about a week, having timed his arrival, as always, to pitchers and catchers. It never took long, a workout or two, for Guidry to get his head back in the game. But his heart beat to a different rhythm, to a conviction that no spring training could really begin until the most famous catcher of all had arrived. That would be Lawrence Peter Barra, the American icon with the most endearing nickname known to man, bestowed on him by a childhood friend because of the yoga-like position he assumed while waiting for his turn to bat during neighborhood sandlot games on benchless St. Louis ball fields. Guidry was at the airport to pick up the 85-year-old package, his dear friend. "My best friend," he would say as a matter of fact, coming for his annual stay of several weeks. "It's like I'm the valet," Guidry said. "Actually, I am the valet." And when Barra hit town, there could be no excuse for failing to be there on time to meet him. Everyone who knew the old man understood the one essential requirement to maintaining a relationship with him. He did not accept lateness, most of all in himself. Guidry knew it as well as anyone in Bera's immediate family. Yogi is never late. So there was little chance, Guidry reasoned, that Flight 518 from the notoriously congested Newark Liberty International Airport would dare fail to touch down at its appointed time. Not with Bera, a man who inspired people earthbound and airborne alike to please him, on board.
That was Driving Mr. Yogi by Harvey Arreton. Wild, From Lost to Found on the Pacific Crest Trail by Cheryl Strayed is a powerful, blazingly honest memoir. The story of an 1,100-mile solo hike that broke down a young woman reeling from catastrophe and built her back up again. At 22, Cheryl thought she'd lost everything. In the wake of her mother's death, her family scattered and her own marriage was soon destroyed. 4 years later, with nothing more to lose, she made the most impulsive decision of her life, to hike the Pacific Crest Trail from the Mojave Desert through California and Oregon to Washington State, and to do it alone. She had no experience as a long-distance hiker, and the trail was little more than an idea. But it was a promise of piecing back together a life that had come undone. Cheryl faced down rattlesnakes and black bears, intense heat and record snowfall, at both the beauty and loneliness of the trail. Told with suspense and style, sparkling with warmth and humor, Wild vividly captures the terror and the pleasure of one young woman forging ahead against all odds on a journey that maddened, strengthened, and ultimately healed her. Bernadette Dunn narrates.
I'd been standing in line at an outdoor store waiting to purchase a foldable shovel when I picked up a book called The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, from a nearby shelf and read the back cover. The PCT, it said, was a continuous wilderness trail that went from the Mexican border in California to just beyond the Canadian border along the crest of 9 mountain ranges: the Laguna, San Jacinto, San Bernardino, San Gabriel, Libre, Tehachapi, Sierra Nevada, Klamath, and Cascades. That distance was 1,000 miles as the crow flies, but the trail was more than double that, traversing the entire length of the states of California, Oregon, and Washington. The PCT passes through national parks and wilderness areas, as well as federal, tribal, and privately held lands, through deserts and mountains and rainforests, across rivers and highways. I turned the book over and gazed at its front cover, a boulder-strewn lake surrounded by rocky crags against a blue sky, then placed it back on the shelf, paid for my shovel, and left. But later I returned and bought the book. The Pacific Crest Trail wasn't a world to me then. It was an idea, vague and outlandish, full of promise and mystery. Something bloomed inside me as I traced its jagged line with my finger on a map. I would walk that line, I decided, or at least as much of it as I could in about 100 days. I was living alone in a studio apartment in Minneapolis, separated from my husband, and working as a waitress, as low and mixed up as I'd ever been in my life. Each day I felt as if I were looking up from the bottom of a deep well. But from that well, I set about becoming a solo wilderness trekker. And why not? I'd been so many things already. A loving wife and an adulteress, a beloved daughter who now spent holidays alone, an ambitious overachiever and aspiring writer who hopped from one meaningless job to the next while dabbling dangerously with drugs and sleeping with too many men. I was the granddaughter of a Pennsylvania coal miner, the daughter of a steelworker turned salesman. After my parents split up, I lived with my mother, brother, and sister in apartment complexes populated by single mothers and their kids. As a teen, I lived back to the land style in the Minnesota North Woods, in a house that didn't have an indoor toilet, electricity, or running water. In spite of this, I'd become a high school cheerleader and homecoming queen, and then I went off to college and became a left-wing feminist campus radical. But a woman who walks alone in the wilderness for 1,100 miles? I'd never been anything like that before. I had nothing to lose by giving it a whirl. It seemed like years ago now, as I stood barefoot on that mountain in California, in a different lifetime, really, when I'd made the arguably unreasonable decision to take a long walk alone on the PCT in order to save myself, when I believed that all the things I'd been before had prepared me for this journey. But nothing had or could. Each day on the trail was the only possible preparation for the one that followed, and sometimes even the day before didn't prepare me for what would happen next. Such as my boots sailing irretrievably over the side of a mountain. The truth is, I was only half sorry to see them go. In the 6 weeks I'd spent in those boots, I'd trekked across deserts and snow, past trees and bushes and grasses and flowers of all shapes and sizes and colors, walked up and down mountains and over fields and glades and stretches of land I couldn't possibly define, except to say that I had been there, passed over it, made it through. And all the while, those boots had blistered my feet and rubbed them raw. They'd caused my nails to blacken and detach themselves excruciatingly from four of my toes. I was done with those boots by the time I lost them, and those boots were done with me. Though it's also true that I loved them.
That was Wild by Cheryl Strayed.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Everyone else, John F. Kennedy Jr. may have been American royalty, but to Rosemarie Terenzio, he was an entitled nuisance, and she wasn't afraid to let him know it. Rosemarie was his personal assistant, his publicist, and one of his closest confidants during the last 5 years of his life. In her first memoir, she recounts the unlikely friendship between a blue-collar girl from the Bronx and John F. Kennedy Jr. Funny, moving, and fresh, Fairy Tale Interrupted, a memoir of life, love, and loss, is a unique account by the woman who was with him through dating, politics, the paparazzi, and his marriage to Carolyn Bessette. Her street smarts paired with loyalty, candor, and relentless work ethic made her the trusted insider. After John and Carolyn's tragic, untimely death, Rosemarie's world came crashing down around her. Many books have sought to capture JFK Jr.'s life, but none has been as intimate or as honest as this true portrait of the man behind the icon. The author narrates.
From the minute it was announced, I got the vibe from John that he didn't want it to take up much of his time. He refused to give me any details and dragged his feet when he had to do something for it. I suspected his trip to Italy was perfectly timed to miss the event. While John acted as if the auction was not a priority, I was fielding numerous calls and requests, not just from the media, but from people wanting to attend the event or get a catalog, yet I didn't have any information. I didn't even know that the brown paper shopping bag he asked me to take to the house of his sister Caroline the week before had been filled with $2 million worth of jewelry. If I had, I would have killed him. John just wanted it to be over, so I had to figure out how to handle it without asking too many annoying questions. I acted like I knew what I was doing. Pretending I'd been there before was my specialty. The mad dash to get John out of the office on time began as soon as he returned that afternoon from his abbreviated workout. There were new phone messages that I had to discuss with him. Is Carolyn also going to the dinner with Leonard Lauder? Nope, it's just work. The Robin Hood Foundation wants you to speak at the next board meeting. Okay, just put it in the calendar and write up some notes. And the auction again. Taylor called a few more times, I said. So did your sister. Okay. Are you going to call them back? I said, I'll call. That was John not dealing with it, I could tell. I wished he'd either tell me what to do or call back, but I couldn't push him anymore unless I wanted my head taken off. Here's the stationery and a pen to write Paul's thank you note, I said, putting both on his desk. It has to go out today. I walked out of his office and went to the bathroom to cool off. We were together almost all day, every day, and working for John opened doors to places I never imagined I'd ever enter, like the hottest clubs in town, the most coveted events, exclusive restaurants, even his house in Hyannis, which he lent me for a week every summer. Carolyn, his wife, and I spoke on the phone about 100 times a day and often hung out after work to talk about boys, clothes, and the latest celebrity gossip. John and I were as close as family, and like family, we got on each other's nerves. When I returned, John's office was empty. He had a lot to do, so where was he? I walked a short way down the hallway. He was in the office of George's publisher, Michael Berman, chit-chatting. John, what are you doing? Shut up, Rosie. Stop nagging. We were both frustrated, but he got up and returned to his office to write the thank you note, returned his last calls, and replied to editor story ideas. Finally, it was 5 o'clock. Time to get him into the car and out of my hair. Car's downstairs, John, I shouted from my chair. 5 minutes went by with no response, so I walked into his office and said, you have to go now. He nodded and started to stand up when Michael walked in to tell him a funny story about his run-in with the publisher of Esquire. Michael, John has to go, I pleaded, but they both ignored me and Michael finished his story. It took another 20 minutes to get John downstairs because people stopped him everywhere, in the hallway, in the elevator, even in the bathroom. Finally, sweet Jesus, we made it outside. On the way to the car, a couple of construction workers spotted John and called out to him, as people always did when they saw him in public. When I first met John one morning, I saw him on the street as I walked to work and shouted his name, but he didn't turn to acknowledge me. Later, I confronted him and asked why he'd been so rude. Rosie, do you know how many people yell, John, when I'm walking down the street? If I turned to every one of them, I'd never get to work. Hey, John, I like your magazine, one of the construction guys yelled. Thanks, but it's one John, he said. I handed him a folder that held absolutely everything he needed. His itinerary, a contact list, stories to edit, stories to review, pages to show the ad people, and more. Do you have your passport in your wallet, I asked. He patted his pocket to double check. John, one more thing. I'm getting a lot of calls about the auction. What should I tell people about that? He shot me a look. How should I know? Do I look like I work at Sotheby's? He was lucky he got in that car or else I would have choked him. Thanks a lot, John, I thought, as the town car rode away. I bought some Camel Lights and packed them into my hand as I walked down the hallway to the creative director Matt Berman's office, which doubles as the magazine's rec room. The office had every new magazine, ashtrays, Diet Coke, and a sofa, all the makings of a good lounge. That's where Carolyn hung out whenever she visited, not in John's office. She'd flop down on the couch, a whirlwind of handbags and stories, and spend hours leafing through magazines and smoking so that by the time she left, Matt's office looked like a nightclub. Now it was my turn on the couch.
That was Fairy Tale Interrupted by Rosemarie Terenzio. George F. Kennan, An American Life by John Lewis Gaddis has just been awarded this year's Pulitzer Prize for Biography. In the late 1940s, George Kennan wrote two documents, The Long Telegram and The X Article, which set forward the strategy of containment that would define U.S. policy toward the Soviet Union for the next 4 decades. This achievement alone would qualify him as the most influential American diplomat of the Cold War. But he was also an architect of the Marshall Plan, a prize-winning historian, and one of the most outspoken critics of American diplomacy, politics, and culture during the last half of the 20th century. Now, the full scope of Kennan's long life and vast influence is revealed by one of today's most important Cold War scholars. Yale historian John Lewis Gaddis began this history almost 30 years ago, interviewing Kennan frequently and gaining complete access to his diaries and personal papers. So frank and detailed were these materials that Kennan and Gaddis agreed that the book would not appear until after Kennan's death. Malcolm Hillgartner narrates this epic.
He and I originally thought of the book as more political than personal, but when we explained this to George's wife, Annalisa, she strongly objected. His writings, she reminded us, were full of gloom and doom. I must get to know him well enough to see that he was not always this way. That, in turn, allowed me to glimpse the stabilizing role she played in his life. It first became clear to me one evening in Princeton in 1983. The Kennans were just back from Norway, and when I asked how it had been, George started complaining about dissolute youth hanging around on the docks. Annalisa put an end to that. "George, you're always worrying about docks." All docks everywhere had dissolute youth. That, along with tying up boats, was what they were for. And then, turning to me, "He worries too much about the docks." Annalisa had her way with this book, and that's why I have dedicated it to her memory. It's by no means the first, though, about George Kennan. I've learned from and respect the work of my predecessors, especially C. Ben Wright, Barton Gellman, Walter Isaacson and Evan Thomas, David Mayers, Walter Hickson, Anders Stephenson, Wilson D. Miscambell, CSC, John Lamberton Harper, Richard L. Russell, John Lukacs, Lee Congdon, Nicholas Thompson, and Frank Costagnola, who will now be editing the Kennan Diaries. But I've made no systematic effort to compare their conclusions, or even some of my own previous ones, with what this book contains. I want it to be a fresh look at Kennan himself, not at the scholarship he has inspired. This is also, despite its length, a selective life. I've given more attention to some episodes than to others, and I've left out a lot. I've done so partly because I think that character emerges more clearly from the choices biographers make than from the comprehensiveness they attempt, partly also out of compassion for my readers. Kennan once recommended to me, as a model, Leon Adell's monumental biography of Henry James. He had in mind, though, Adell's psychological insights, not the five volumes required to convey them. Finally, a note on names. First ones are necessary when writing about family, as an older sister of George's pointed out when I began an early interview with the question, "What was Professor Kennan like as a baby?" At the same time, it seemed inappropriate to write, in later chapters, of George's long telegram or his X article, so I have used George within the context of family and Kennan elsewhere. I have also, following the custom of Kennan and his generation, occasionally used the term Russians when discussing the inhabitants of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. I am fully aware that a substantial minority were not Russians, but I also know how cumbersome it would be to have to remind readers repeatedly of this fact. I ask their indulgence in being reminded here. George Kennan's willingness to entrust me with a biography he would never read was, from the beginning, an extraordinary expression of confidence. How much so came through all over again in 2002, on one of the last visits my wife Tony and I paid to the Kennans at their Princeton home. George showed me a stack of loose-leaf binders containing the only copy of his diary from 1970 until that moment. "They go with you," he said to my astonishment. "But I guess you wouldn't be interested in this," he added, indicating a single smaller volume. "What is it?" "Oh, just my dream diary." "Take it, too," Annalisa insisted. I didn't argue. Never have I driven more carefully back to New Haven. Whether I have merited the trust both Kennans placed in me, I do not know. They were my companions, though, through a considerable portion of my life, and that, for me, was a great privilege. Now that we have reached, with the completion of this book, the point of parting, I can see how much I will miss them. John Lewis Gaddis, New Haven, Connecticut, July 2011.
That was George F. Kennan by John Lewis Gaddis. Yes, the book report covers rock stars and Pulitzer Prize winners. We're all over the literary landscape, hopefully helping you solve the universal conundrum. What should I read next? Still stumped? Check out my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us. See you back here next week on The Book Report.